This is the first in a series of sessions on short fiction that I'll be doing this week on healing the body and the soul in tune with this summer's theme of healing the world. I tried to pick short stories that I knew were in volumes that were in the Holden Library and that had some connection with themes of healing. I guess I'm supposed to introduce myself as well. I'm David Weed. I'm a professor of English at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. And one of my favorite things to do is to come to Holden Village every other January to teach a course on short fiction here. And it's my favorite teaching experience because I'm with students all day, every day, and we do dishes together and toss firewood together, ski together, as well as study together and talk about good literature in this room. Today we'll talk about two short stories by Flannery O'Connor. Just in case it's not clear to you, Flannery O'Connor is a woman. She's got an odd first name, and you know, some people have no reason to know that this is a woman rather than a man. Flannery O'Connor grew up in Milledgeville, Georgia. She lived in the Deep South, went to school in the North, and some early evidence that she was a writer and a word person. But then she discovered she was suffering from lupus and left the North and returned to the family farm where she grew up in Milledgeville, raised peacocks, and died at age 39, very sadly, because she has left us a body of absolutely remarkable short fiction. Some of my favorite short stories of all time. The two that we'll talk about today are Revelation and Everything That Rises Must Converge. Now, normally when I'm teaching short stories, it's to 20-year-olds who have read the stories in advance, allegedly. so we can proceed with that understanding that everyone has read it. I'm not going to assume that all of you have read this or any stories by Flannery O'Connor. So what I'm going to spend part of the time doing today and each day this week is to read parts of the story to you, not the whole story, but read parts of it so that you get a flavor of the voice of each writer and can actually hear some of the episodes and some of the speeches. Most writers, if you were to ask them, please, would you explain this story? The writer will say, well, just read it. Reading the story itself is the way to understand and interpret a story. Many writers resist too much interpretation and analysis. But many of us as readers need to help each other respond to texts, and we discover that we have quite a range of different responses to certain writers. I'm always fascinated as I teach that half the class will love a certain text, and the other half of the class will hate it, or at least not understand it and wonder what was this all about. So we will I'll go through some of these two of these stories today, if we can make it, and I'll read parts of them, let you know what happened to fill in between the parts that I read. And if any of you are interested in reading these stories later, I've put 6 copies of all of the stories for this week on reserve in the library. So right inside the library door, there are 6 reserved copies, so if you wish to read any of these after we talk about them, or read in advance stories for later on, they're available. Flannery O'Connor died in 1964. She lived in the Deep South. She wrote very realistically about the people she knew and about attitudes of human beings, especially Christians. She was a devout Christian, and yet has written some of the most bizarre stories, violent stories, stories with tough language sometimes, in being realistic about the communities in which she lived. She used the language that people used. There's a lot of use of the word nigger, for instance, in her stories. And we hate that word, but you know, that's what you're going to hear in some cases in here. That's the way the people of the Deep South talked in the earlier half of the last century. But I hope that as you hear these voices, you'll recognize the great ear that Flannery O'Connor has for dialogue, for speech. That you'll recognize her sense of humor. She is hilarious in the portrayal of some of her characters and some of the events that happen. And at the same time, or shortly after the hilarity, there will be something shocking and strange and difficult to understand. But underneath it all, Flannery O'Connor is a devout Christian. And she is writing about the human spirit, and you know, what we call the human condition, and our soul, our relationship to God and to creation. Now, the two stories that I picked for today both begin with references to doctors. The first one, Revelation, begins with this sentence: "The doctor's waiting room, which was very small, was almost full when the Turpins entered." Most of the story takes place in a small, cramped doctor's waiting room with people coming in to have their physical ailments cared for. What we discover by the end of the story is that the physical ailments are minor. It's the spiritual illness that Flannery O'Connor is really interested in, and that she finds ways to resolve. In Everything That Rises Must Converge, the story begins: "Her doctor had told Julian's mother that she must lose 20 pounds on account of her blood pressure." So again, we're told right off the bat that here's somebody with a physical ailment. Again, by the time we're finished, physical ailments diminish in relationship to the spiritual conditions that Flannery O'Connor is really interested in. And you may interrupt at any time, and I'll interrupt the reading of the story to tell what happens next, and if you have questions, why, please interrupt. So if you wish, you may just sit back and relax and enjoy Flannery O'Connor's storytelling, but we'll have time to discuss the human implications of all of this as we proceed and afterwards. So here's the beginning of Revelation. A good theological title. "The doctor's waiting room, which was very small, was almost full when the Turpins entered, and Mrs. Turpin, who was very large, made it look even smaller by her presence. She stood looming at the head of the magazine table set in the center of it, a living demonstration that the room was inadequate and ridiculous. Her little bright black eyes took in all the patients as she sized up the seating situation. There was one vacant chair and a place on the sofa occupied by a blonde child in a dirty blue romper who should have been told to move over and make room for the lady. He was 5 or 6, but Mrs. Turpin saw at once that no one was going to tell him to move over. He was slumped down in the seat, his arms idle at his sides, and his eyes idle in his head. His nose ran unchecked. Mrs. Turpin put a firm hand on Claude's shoulder and said in a voice that included anyone who wanted to listen, "Claude, you sit in that chair there," and gave him a push down into the vacant one. Claude was florid and bald and sturdy, somewhat shorter than Mrs. Turpin, but he sat down as if he were accustomed to doing what she told him to. You can sense a lot of Flannery O'Connor's editorial and informative comments. So they sit down. Someone asks what she's there for, and she says, "No, it's Claude. He's got a sore on his leg." He puts his leg up and pulls back his pant leg and shows everybody the sore on his leg. Meanwhile, Mrs. Turpin begins looking around and evaluating all of the people in the room with great irritation and lack of charity. And you'll notice that in some of the narrative that Flannery O'Connor gives, she's not speaking in her own voice as author, but you hear Mrs. Turpin's language and Mrs. Turpin's attitudes, even though she's not actually speaking. The inner door opened, and a nurse with the highest stack of yellow hair Mrs. Turpin had ever seen put her face in the crack and called for the next patient. The woman sitting beside Claude grasped the two arms of her chair and hoisted herself up. She pulled her dress free from her legs and lumbered through the door where the nurse had disappeared. Mrs. Turpin eased into the vacant chair, which held her tight as a corset. "I wish I could reduce," she said, and rolled her eyes and gave a comic sigh. "Oh, you aren't fat," the stylish lady said. "Ooh, I am too," Mrs. Turpin said. "Claude, he eats all he wants to and never weighs over 175 pounds, but me, I just look at something good to eat and I gain some weight." And her stomach and shoulders shook with laughter. "You can eat all you want to, can't you, Claude?" she asked, turning to him. Claude only grinned. "Well, as long as you have such a good disposition," the stylish lady said, one of the other people in the waiting room, "I don't think it makes a bit of difference what size you are. You just can't beat a good disposition." Next to her was a fat girl of 18 or 19, scowling into a thick blue book, which Mrs. Turpin saw was entitled Human Development. The girl raised her head and directed her scowl at Mrs. Turpin as if she did not like her looks. She appeared annoyed that anyone should speak while she tried to read. The poor girl's face was blue with acne, and Mrs. Turpin thought how pitiful it was to have a face like that at that age. She gave the girl a friendly smile, but the girl only scowled the harder. Mrs. Turpin herself was fat, but she had always had good skin, and though she was 47 years old, there was not a wrinkle in her face except around her eyes from laughing too much. Throughout the story, we see Mrs. Turpin, you know, constantly evaluating the others. And one of the things I love about Flannery O'Connor's stories is that often the bad people are college people. Here's the college student. We learn that this girl with all the acne is a college student, and ironically, she's reading a book called Human Development, and you know, hasn't learned a lot from that book. Next to the ugly girl was the child, still in exactly the same position, and next to him was a thin, leathery old woman in a cotton print dress. She and Claude had three sacks of chicken feed in their pump house that was in the same print. She had seen from the first that the child belonged with the old woman. She could tell by the way they sat, kind of vacant and white trashy, as if they would sit there until doomsday if nobody called and told them to get up. And at right angles, but next to the well-dressed, pleasant lady, was a lank-faced woman who was certainly the child's mother. She had on a yellow sweatshirt and wine-colored slacks, both gritty-looking, and the rims of her lips were stained with snuff. Her dirty yellow hair was tied behind with a little piece of red paper ribbon. "Worse than niggers any day," Mrs. Turpin thought. The gospel hymn playing was When I looked up and he looked down, and Mrs. Turpin, who knew it, supplied the last line mentally, "And one of these days, I know I'll wear a crown." So we see here over and over again the self-righteousness of Mrs. Turpin, the good Christian person in this story, identifying everyone else as niggers or white trash or ugly and, you know, inappropriate. Sometimes at night when she couldn't go to sleep, Mrs. Turpin would occupy herself with the question of who she would have chosen to be if she couldn't have been herself. If Jesus had said to her before he made her, "There's only two places available for you. You can either be a nigger or white trash," what would she have said? "Please, Jesus, please," she would have said, "just let me wait until there's another place available." And he would have said, "No, you have to go right now. And I have only those two places, so make up your mind." She would have wiggled and squirmed and begged and pleaded, but it would have been no use. And finally she would have said, "All right, make me a nigger then. But that don't mean a trashy one." And he would have made her a neat, clean, respectable Negro woman, herself but black. Next to the child's mother was a red-headed youngish woman, reading one of the magazines and working a piece of chewing gum, hell for leather, as Claude would say. Mrs. Turpin could not see the woman's feet. She was not white trash, just common. Sometimes Mrs. Turpin occupied herself at night naming the classes of people. On the bottom of the heap were the most colored people, not the kind she would have been if she had been one, but most of them. Then next to them, not above, just away from, were the white trash. Then above them were the homeowners, and above them, the home and landowners to which she and Claude belonged. Above she and Claude were people with a lot of money and much bigger houses and much more land. But here the complexity of it would begin to bear in on her. For some of the people with a lot of money were common and ought to be below she and Claude. And some of the people who had good blood had lost their money and had to rent. And then there were colored people who owned their homes and land as well. So on she goes, you know, categorizing everybody at all. A lot of inane conversation goes on. Flannery O'Connor is brilliant at having her characters live by cliches. And you know, any of us would be driven mad if we listened to the kind of inane cliches that happen here. They start talking about what they do. And Mrs. Turpin said, "We got a couple of acres of cotton and a few hogs and chickens and just enough whiteface that Claude can look after them himself." "One thing I don't want," the white trash woman said, wiping her mouth with the back of her hands, "hogs, nasty stinking things, a grunting and a rooting all over the place." Mrs. Turpin gave her the merest edge of her attention. "Our hogs are not dirty, and they don't stink," she said. "They're cleaner than some children I've seen. Their feet never touch the ground. We have a pig parlor. That's where you raise them on concrete," she explained to the pleasant lady. "And Claude scoops them down with the hose every afternoon and washes off the floor." Cleaner by far than that child right there, she thought. Mm-hmm. Poor nasty little thing. He had not moved except to put the thumb of his dirty hand into his mouth. The woman turned her face away from Mrs. Turpin. "I know I wouldn't scoop down no hog with no hose," she said to the wall. Mrs. Turpin said to herself, "You wouldn't have no hog to scoop down." So here goes this antagonism. And then a little more attention now to the pimply-faced girl, 18 or 19-year-old, who's reading the book Human Development. At one point, after one of the ladies says, "Yes, and it takes all kinds to make the world go round," as she said it, the raw complexion girl snapped her teeth together. Her lower lip turned downwards and inside out, revealing the pale pink inside of her mouth. After a second, it rolled back up, was the ugliest face Mrs. Turpin had ever seen anyone make, and for a moment, she was certain that the girl had made it at her. She was looking at her as if she had known and disliked her all her life. All of Mrs. Turpin's life, too, it seemed, not just all the girl's life. So here Mrs. Turpin has a sense that there's something directed specifically toward her from that girl. Then after more talk that angers the girl, Mrs. Turpin says to herself, "Girl, I haven't done a thing to you." The girl might be confusing her with somebody else. There was no need to sit by and let herself be intimidated. "You must be in college," she said boldly, looking directly at the girl. "I see you reading a book there." Connor is just great at pointing out the cultural truths of her society. Her mother addresses the girl, says, "Speak to the lady, she just spoke to you. Speak to her, Mary Grace." And here we learn that this ugly girl's name is Mary Grace, which is very important in this story. And the mother says that Mary Grace goes to Wellesley College and spends all the time reading even after she's home in the summertime. Then after more irritating talk, the mother says this, "I think the worst thing in the world is an ungrateful person to have everything and not appreciate it. I know a girl," she said, "who has parents who would give her anything, a little brother who loves her dearly, who is getting a good education, who wears the best clothes, but who can never say a kind word to anyone, who never smiles, who just criticizes and complains all day long." Here she's talking about her daughter sitting right next to her in this horrible way. And here's Mrs. Turpin's response. "If it's one thing I am," Mrs. Turpin said with feeling, "it's grateful. When I think who all I could have been besides myself, and what all I got, a little of everything and a good disposition besides, I just feel like shouting, 'Thank you, Jesus, for making everything the way it is. It could have been different. For one thing, somebody else could have got clawed.'" At the thought of this, she was flooded with gratitude, and a terrible pang of joy ran through her. "Oh, thank you, Jesus, Jesus, thank you," she cried out loud. The book struck her directly over the left eye. It struck almost at the same instant that she realized the girl was about to hurl it. Before she could utter a sound, the raw face came crashing across the table toward her, howling. The girl's fingers sank like clamps into the soft flesh of her neck. She heard the mother cry out and Claude shout, "Whoa!" There was an instant when she was certain that she was about to be in an earthquake. So after finally not being able to stand this, you know, self-righteous talk, the girl takes this big, heavy college textbook and throws it across the room, hits Mrs. Turpin in the head, and then comes and tries to strangle.
You can't help but wonder if the college girl is O'Connor's representation of herself.
Yeah, I mean, she, Flannery O'Connor, went north. I can't remember what college she went to, but one like Wellesley. And she recognizes the dangers of being the educated person. And we get, in many of her stories, both the educated and the uneducated make horrible kind of spiritual mistakes. Finally, the doctors come rushing in and pin down the girl and pull her hands away from Mrs. Turpin's throat, and they give her a sedative injection. And we read, Mrs. Turpin's head cleared, and her power of motion returned. She's still on the floor, and so is the girl. She leaned forward until she was looking directly into the fierce, brilliant eyes. There was no doubt in her mind that the girl did know her, knew her then in some intense and personal way, beyond time and place and condition. She has an insight that this is more than just a casual encounter here. "What you got to say to me?" she asked hoarsely and held her breath, waiting as for a revelation. and she gets it. The girl raised her head, her gaze locked with Mrs. Turpin's. "Go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog," she whispered. Her voice was low but clear. Her eyes burned for a moment as if she saw with pleasure that her message had struck its target. Mrs. Turpin sank back in her chair, and the girl's eyes closed and turned wearily to the side. So I just, you know, imagine this scene. And Mrs. Turpin has been told to go back to hell where she came from, the old warthog. And she, all along, her whole life, in fact, has been seeing herself as the right kind of people. And that she's good to everybody. She has a wonderful disposition. And it has totally infuriated somebody else in the room. Well, Mrs. Turpin and Claude go home, take a long nap. And then she gets up and goes to the pig pen where they do wash down the hogs. And here's another little room scene filled with the heavy creatures, the hogs. But Mrs. Turpin this time is on the outside, furiously just squirting the hose right at the pigs in the pen. And then she begins to speak, and it's clear that she's speaking to God. "What do you send me a message like that for?" she said in a low, fierce voice, barely above a whisper, but with the force of a shout in its concentrated fury. "How am I a hog and me both? How am I saved and from hell too?" And she shakes her fist at the skies. She goes on talking to God, you know, "You could have made me white trash, you know, but why didn't you attack the white trash in the waiting room? You know, why didn't you call them a warthog?" She clearly sees what she was told by Mary Grace as a revelation from God, and it was directed to her. You know, here's a sign of her faith and her insight. And then the last thing she says to God is this. She braced herself for a final assault, and this time her voice rolled out over the pasture. "Go on," she yelled. "Call me a hog. Call me a hog again from hell. Call me a warthog from hell. Put that bottom rail on top. There'll still be a top and a bottom." A garbled echo returned to her. A final surge of fury shook her, and she roared, "Who do you think you are?" Color of everything, field and crimson sky burned for a moment with a transparent intensity. The question carried over the pasture and across the highway and the cotton field and returned to her clearly like an answer from beyond the wood. "Who do you think you are?" She opened her mouth, but no sound came of it. It's the final thing that shuts her up when she gets a sense that God is saying to her, "Who do you think you are?" And then the story ends with a vision that she has. The sun is setting, there's beautiful and spectacular colors in the sky. And she sees a streak in the sky as a vast swinging bridge extending upward from the earth through a field of living fire. Upon it, a vast horde of souls were rumbling toward heaven. There were whole companies of white trash, clean for the first time in their lives, and bands of black niggers in white robes, and battalions of freaks and lunatics, shouting and clapping and leaping like frogs. And bringing up the end of the procession was a tribe of people whom she recognized at once as those who, like herself and Claude, had always had a little of everything and the God-given wit to use it right. She came forward to observe them closer. They were marching behind the others with great dignity, accountable as they always had been for good order and common sense and respectable behavior. They alone were on key. Yet she could see by their shocked and altered faces that even their virtues were being burned away. So she has this revelation. Here's this huge woman as many of Flannery O'Connor's characters wanting to dominate, to exert power, to be better than others, categorizing others as lower, lesser. And she has in the unlikeliest places in the doctor's waiting room this bizarre experience where this ugly, acne-filled person, whose name is Mary Grace, she is the source of grace for Mrs. Turpin and provides for her the revelation that she is not as good as she thinks she is. And of course, this is what Flannery O'Connor's stories are intended to do for all of us. Most of us think we're the good guys. And we tend to categorize a lot of other people, stereotype them. We're glad that we've made the choices we've done, that we've got talents and we made good use of them. And it's very easy to make negative comments about others. It's a common human activity. And Flannery O'Connor is, in this story, is providing a revelation to Mrs. Turpin, which ought to be a revelation to us, that we are Mrs. Turpin. We are constantly self-righteous. Let's face it. You know, we make judgments about other people all the time, and usually we consider ourselves the top rail and others are the middle or the bottom rail, one way or another. And Flannery O'Connor is always recognizing the gospel, recognizing what Jesus would have us understand, that we are all sinful. None of us is in a position to consider ourselves better than anyone else. And something needs to bring us to our senses. And it often comes from the unlikeliest source. In this case, the ugly girl in the room who brings the revelation by just throwing a book and hitting her right in the head and then trying to choke her to death, almost succeeding, and telling her in fairly harsh language, go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog. That she needs to reshape her self-image and not consider herself as better and above everyone else morally. It's hard to read this, and we laugh in one sense because Mrs. Turpin is a ridiculous figure. You know, she is so pompous and self-righteous. And we read her thoughts and we hear her voice condemning others and all the cliches of the self-righteous with which she lives her life. And Mary Grace never says a word in the whole story except the revelation, go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog, and throws the book at her. Probably it, you know, O'Connor wants us to think, well, it might have been the Bible, you know. But that's what O'Connor is throwing at us, is the Bible and the gospel message and the fact that we all need a wake-up call. Sometimes we are so stuck in our self-righteousness that it takes something violent to pull us out of it. I'll read you a sentence or two from one of Flannery O'Connor's statements about her own writing. She wrote this, because people always ask her about violence in the stories. This is the least violent thing that we're going to encounter in the stories this week. I suppose the reasons for the use of so much violence in modern fiction will differ with each writer who uses it. But in my own stories, I have found that violence is strangely capable of returning my characters to reality and preparing them to accept their moment of grace. Their heads are so hard that almost nothing else will do the work. So she is writing about grace, and it comes from Mary Grace in this story. And it takes that that book in the head and that scathing comment right to her face to make her realize, I have heard God speaking to me. And she shouts back at God, you know, why did you do this to me? Why didn't you have it done to one of these other lesser people? Who do you think you are? And then God provides this vision for her. It shows her exactly who she is. She's one of the good people who are at the back of the pack as everyone is marching off to heaven. It's the blacks and the lunatics and the white trash who are singing and rejoicing and on their way to heaven and marching along stolidly in the back with their very virtues being burned on them are us, the ones where, to whom we always associate ourselves, the good people, the church people. Well, I recommend you read the whole story. It's better than I've made it out to be. The other story, for today, Everything That Rises Must Converge, takes place mostly on a city bus. This is the one that begins with the line, her doctor had told Julian's mother that she must lose 20 pounds on account of her blood pressure. So on Wednesday nights, Julian had to take her downtown on the bus for a reducing class at the Y. And I'll read a few paragraphs of this one. And here again, we get Julian the son is college educated and recognizes how smart he is, despises his mother in the way that Mrs. Turpin despised what she called white trash in the room, because her mother just doesn't have the wisdom that he, Julian's son, has got. And in the story, we see the interaction, and especially the attitudes, between Julian and his mother. As Julian is trying to get his mother to recognize that she's living in the past, that she's prejudiced, unlike himself, and that she's got to shape up. The first paragraph, I've read the first sentence. The reducing class was designed for working girls over 50 who weighed from 165 to 200 pounds. His mother was one of the slimmer ones, but she said ladies did not tell their age or weight. She would not ride the buses by herself at night since they had been integrated. And because the reducing class was one of her few pleasures necessary for her health and free, she said Julian could at least put himself out to take her, considering all she did for him. Julian did not like to consider all she did for him, but every Wednesday night he braced himself and took her. As they're starting to leave, the mother is trying to decide what hat to wear. She's got to be dressed up to get on the bus and go down to the Y for the reducing class. She says, I shouldn't have bought this hat. Yes, you should have bought it, he said. Put it on and let's go. It was a hideous hat. A purple velvet flap came down on one side of it and stood up on the other. The rest of it was green and looked like a cushion with the stuffing out. He decided it was less comical than jaunty and pathetic. Everything that gave her pleasure was small and depressed him. So again, you see here this ungracious response of the son toward the mother. So here he is, feeling like a martyr, taking his mother to reducing class. And they have all sorts of conversations along the way, filled with the usual cliches. Rome wasn't built in a day. The world in the mess it's in, it's a wonder we can enjoy anything. I tell you, the bottom rail is on the top. These are the kinds of cliches that Flannery O'Connor obviously heard in town every day. And in the process of Julian being furious at his mother for being so out of it, she said in this class, about the reducing class. Most of them in it are not our kind of people, but I can be gracious to anybody. I know who I am. Julian responds savagely, they don't give a damn for your graciousness. Knowing who you are is good for one generation only. You haven't the foggiest idea of where you stand now or who you are. She stopped and allowed her eyes to flash at him. I most certainly do know who I am. And if you don't know who you are, I'm ashamed of you. You can hear the same language as from the previous story when Mrs. Turpin says, who do you think you are? And here's an echo back as if from God. Here's Julian and his mother claiming. The mother says, I know who I am. You know, I'm one of the upright people. I'm one of the good people. And he says, you don't know who you are because you're living in an unrealistic world. So they are waiting for the bus to come, quibbling constantly. He just to irritate her, he takes off his necktie, and she says, well, I may as well just go back if you can't even dress up to take me to the Y. So he says, all right, restored to my class, he muttered. He thrust his face toward her and hissed, true culture is in the mind. The mind, he said, and tapped his head. The mind. It's in the heart, she said, and in how you do things. And how you do things is because of who you are. He says, nobody in the damn bus cares who you are. She said icily, I care who I am. So you see, we've got this conflict of classes going. When he gets too furious, he withdraws into his bubble, he calls it. He was withdrawing into the inner compartment of his mind where he spent most of his time. This was a kind of mental bubble in which he established himself when he could not bear to be a part of what was going on around him. From it he could see out and judge, but in it he was safe from any kind of penetration from without. It was the only place where he felt free of the general idiocy of his fellows. His mother had never entered it, but from it he could see her with absolute clarity. So here he is, the college-educated person, believing that he has the direct answer and insight and wisdom on everything. And what we discover by the end of the story is that he is completely wrong about his mother and particularly about himself and his own, the state of his soul. She had brought him up successfully and had sent him to college, and that he had turned out so well, good looking, her teeth had grown unformed, so that his could be straightened. Intelligent, he realized he was too intelligent to be a success. And with a future ahead of him, there was, of course, no future ahead of him. She excused his gloominess on the grounds that he was still growing up, and she excused his radical ideas on his lack of practical experience. She said he didn't yet know a thing about life, and that he hadn't even entered the real world. And already he was as disenchanted with it as a man of 50. And he says the further irony of this is that in spite of her, he had turned out so well. In spite of going to only a third-rate college, he had, on his own initiative, come out with a first-rate education. In spite of growing up dominated by a small mind, he had ended up with a large one. In spite of all her foolish views, he was free of prejudice and unafraid to face facts. Most miraculous of all, instead of being blinded by love for her, as she was for him, he had cut himself emotionally free of her and could see her with complete objectivity. Now here's one of the things that the great writers write about, and that is the importance of human connection, of loving one another. Here's a son who is proud of the fact that he has cut himself emotionally free of his mother, who has made all these sacrifices for him, which he doesn't want to hear about. And he's sure that he is completely unprejudiced. what we learned is that he, in his sense of integrating himself with the rest of his culture, he has tried to befriend black people. He has never been able to make a friend with Negro, he says here. Never been successful. He tried to strike up acquaintances with some of the better types of black people, but, you know, fails miserably every time. They're sitting on the bus, and well-dressed black man, businessman, comes and sits down. So Julian sits next to Julian. So he, just to show he's on the same level with him, he asks him for a light, and the man, you know, hands him a book of matches, goes back to reading his paper. Julian's looking at the matches. There's a no smoking sign on the bus. And he doesn't have cigarettes anyway. He just is making gestures, going through the motions of being cozy with black people. Then the bus stops, and on the bus comes a huge black woman. And she is wearing a hat. Julian's mother was so proud of the hat because she says, at least I won't see myself coming and going. This is a unique hat. On comes this black woman who had on a hideous hat. A purple velvet flap came down on one side of it and stood up on the other. The rest of it was green and looked like a cushion with the stuffing out. The exact same words. It's the exact same hat. And Julian is just delighted, you know, that at last this is going to teach his mother a lesson, that she is not above the black community, but here she's on the exact par with them. And furthermore, this woman has a little boy, and the little boy starts playing with Julian's mother, and Julian goes over and sits down next to the black woman. So he's enjoying the irony of this interracial contrast of white Julian next to the black mother and the little black boy next to Julian's mother, and just hoping that his mother is going to get it and see the distinction of all this. The black woman, of course, doesn't want her little boy to have anything to do with Julian's mother and snatches him away and finally gets up and pulls the buzzer to stop the bus at the next stop, which is the stop where Julian and his mother have to get off at the Y as well. Julian's mother reaches into her bag because she wants to give a nickel to the little black boy. Julian says, "Don't do it. It's the worst thing you could do, seeing it as a condescending, patronizing act." And the black woman and her little boy get off first and start to walk down the sidewalk, and Julian's mother finds only a penny in her purse, but it's a new one. So she runs after the mother and the little boy to give him a penny. And here's, I'll read this little paragraph. "Oh, little boy," Julian's mother called and took a few quick steps and caught up with them just beyond the lamppost. "Here's a bright new penny for you." And she held out the coin, which shone bronze in the dim light. The huge woman turned and for a moment stood, her shoulders lifted and her face frozen with frustrated rage, and stared at Julian's mother. Then all at once she seemed to explode like a piece of machinery that had been given 1 ounce of pressure too much. Julian saw the black fist swing out with the red pocketbook. This woman has been carrying huge, heavy red pocketbook. He shut his eyes and cringed as he heard the woman shout, "He don't take nobody's pennies." When he opened his eyes, the woman was disappearing down the street with the little boy staring wide-eyed over her shoulder. Julian's mother was sitting on the sidewalk. She hauled off and just whacked Julian's mother with this huge, heavy purse right in the head. And just like Mary Grace threw the heavy book at Mrs. Turpin. "I told you not to do that," Julian said angrily. "I told you not to do it." He stood over her for a minute, gritting his teeth. Her legs were stretched out in front of her, and her hat was on her lap. He squatted down and looked her in the face. It was totally expressionless. "You got exactly what you deserved," he said. "Now get up." And she gets up, and she's obviously had a stroke or a heart attack. You know, we learned in the very first sentence that it was because of her blood pressure weight that she's taking these reducing classes. And Julian is just furious with her and says, "I told you so," and says, "That wasn't just one black woman, that was the whole Negro race, you know, getting back at you for your prejudice." And he says to her, "You aren't who you think you are." And she begins to stagger off down the sidewalk, just like a child. And he catches up to her, looked into her face, and caught his breath. He was looking into a face he had never seen before. And she starts to call for her Negro nurse, who was her friend when she was growing up. And Julian realizes this has been a major event. He had said to his mother, "You know, shape up, it won't kill you." It has killed her. And in the next paragraph, she collapses on the sidewalk. He looks into her face, which is fiercely distorted, one eye large and staring, moved slightly to the left, as if it had become unmoored. The other remained fixed on him, raked his face again, found nothing, and closed. So she, you know, looking into the eyes of her own son and finds nothing. And what we realize is that Julian is the one who has not known who he is and has this same kind of sense of pride and superiority, self-righteousness that Mrs. Turpin had in the previous story. And his mother dies there on the sidewalk as he goes running off for help and into a future of darkness and guilt. So here's another story, similar kind of situation. Confrontation between different people, in this case on a bus instead of in a doctor's waiting room. One of the self-righteous people, Julian's mother, is just hammered in the head with a very heavy pocketbook, and it's given her a shock that has killed her. And Julian, in watching this happen, at first says, "I told you so, you got exactly what you deserved, you're such a prejudiced woman." And suddenly she looks at him, sees nothing, and dies. And he realizes, and this is his revelation, that he is not the wise young man that he had thought. The last words he says to her, after all of the contemptuous statements he has said, he calls to her, "Mother, darling, sweetheart, mama, mama." He instinctively, finally, is identifying her as a loved one and as his own mother, a kind of change from that whole emotional break that he was so proud of having created. But it's too late. It's too late for him, it's too late for his mother. And the revelation has come to Julian in the same way it did to Mrs. Turpin. Flannery O'Connor doesn't let us know what happens next, either to Mrs. Turpin in the one story or to Julian in this story. But what she's really hoping for is that you and I will realize what must be next for us. I mean, these stories are supposed to be, you know, our book in the head or curse against our face, and waking us up to our own prejudices, our own self-righteousness, the ways in which we cut ourselves off from people who are different from us, even from our own families, even from a mother, by having a sense of of intellectual and moral superiority. And most of us can remember with embarrassment, as I can, from when I was a college student and thought I knew more than my parents about certain things. All these sophomoric thoughts, but fortunately I was a sophomore. Have now become a senior and understand things a little differently. But both these stories, with their violence, their shocking characters, their overt prejudice, in sometimes hilarious exchanges between people, ultimately have a revelation of what it means to be a child of God, and that is to love everyone unconditionally, not according to whether they're white trash or niggers, to use the term that Mrs. Turpin and the others use so much. And not even to cut ourselves off from our own family members when we have a sense of superiority. I think her stories are wonderful. I urge you to, you know, read the whole thing, because you've just heard little excerpts here, and see the way in which Flannery O'Connor develops these characters more fully than we've had time to do, and portrays their thinking and their language and their behavior, and then brings it all up short, usually through violence. Because as I read to you, she believes that most of us are hard-headed enough that we need something violent to wake us up to who we are, and to who God is, and to who our brothers and sisters in the world are, and come to treat each other with love instead of hatred and patronizing and condescension. We're going to stop in 3 minutes, giving you lots of time to talk. Do you have any questions
What does, it's interesting, because in some ways she's having God speak then through violence.
Yeah.
Is that pretty consistent in a lot of ways?
Yeah. I mean, most of us, when we're treated gently all the time, doesn't shake us out of our prejudices. You know, many of us remember the civil rights movement, and you know, everyone was, all the white folks, all those of us in power and authority and privilege, were patient and saying, "Oh, it'll change eventually," or "It should always be this way." And it wasn't until black people got in our face and said, "Look, you know, this is wrong," that we began to wake up and see it and begin to pass laws. You know, it's taken huge efforts on the part of women to, you know, wake up the male patriarchy in Western culture, not just Western culture, others as well. And, you know, it hasn't happened just by when women have simply obeyed and kept in their place and not complained. You know, we usually have to be confronted. And Flannery O'Connor's view is that we need to be confronted hard. And that's what the gospel story is about. Yeah.
Just wondering, historically, David, if she died in 1863, she talked about getting on an integrated bus. And she must have done the bulk of her writing then in the 1950s, probably, late 40s or 50s. It must have been really close to the Civil Rights Act.
The Civil Rights Act was 64, wasn't it?
Yeah, I know. And I was surprised it was an integrated bus before she died.
I don't recall, maybe some of you do, whether civic local integration of buses and such happened city by city and before we made national laws.
How were her stories accepted, in the 50s? Do you think this was part of the impetus to the civil rights movement?
Well, everything about the Rise of Us Converge was written apparently in May of 64, so it's true.
Was written what?
May of 64.
May of 64. Okay.
So I guess at that time, things are just happening.
I don't know if we can credit these stories for achieving any civil rights actions, but she's much admired by both Christians and non-Christians alike. And those of us who get affected by her stories and can look ourselves in the mirror and realize we're wrong and we've got to change, you know, it's had that kind of effect, I think, on many individuals, at least.
It's just funny how people who have things sort of right in some way are actually the anti-hero, the sort of villain. The son, all these, you know, seemingly progressive, wonderful attitudes is really the jerk to his mother and, you know, the darkness and guilt going on. And Mrs. Turpin, she, you know, she gives, you know, she's somewhat charitable to people, although she she lets be known that her sunshine to the Negroes is fake, but she always gives people who needs it, even though they don't really deserve it or can't do well with it.
Yeah, I mean, she's doing good things, but always for the wrong reason. Always for her own sense of self-righteousness and totaling up points in heaven from when she gets there eventually. Yeah.
And I noticed that the bottom rung is now the top rung was used in both stories.
Both stories, yeah. Well, most of us tend to think of ourselves as being the top rung folks. And Flannery O'Connor is helping us recognize that there is no real top rung and bottom rung in the eyes of God, you know, and that any of us who take that kind of attitude through life are missing the gospel message. Well, it is 7:20. We've got Vespers in a few minutes. So I